Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on this 15th day of December, 2013. Oh, yes, the year is very old, has a big, long, white beard. As we prepare to go out with the old, in with the new 2014, ladies and gentlemen. And as Matt Drudge said about a year ago on his Twitter feed, 2014 is everything. And I already knew that and had thought about that. But in the last year, I think about that tweet almost every day because I realized that 2014, to a great extent, will probably be the most important year in our lifetimes. Not just for this country, but every other nation. All of the dots are connecting. Everything is intersecting in 2014. That doesn't mean things won't be a lot crazier, for better and worse, after that. But the set of things, the way it's going to go, so much of it is 2014. Liken it like the Bible does to bringing up a child and then releasing them into the world, like drawing an arrow back on your bow and then releasing. And then once you've released, it's out of your hands to a great extent when the child's 16, 17, 18 years old. It's the same thing. So much of what we've seen is the pulling back of the arrow and the different forces battling for where that arrow is going to go. And now it's up. And the forces are all engaged, and 2014 is the release of the arrow.
Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is John Lash, your navigator, recording in the early hours of the morning, December 17th, 2013. This is Nav Briefing 97, and its title is The End of Jumanity. So I thought I'd give you a little blast in my introduction there. Of course, you are hearing from well-known shock jock, Alex Jones. And I thought it was remarkable that Jones was speaking on the 15th of December, which is the day of the full moon in the Kurukula shift of 2013. The Kurukula shift lasts until January 1st, when there is a changeover to the Mahakali shift. So the year 2014 commences with a shift of Mahakali. I thought it was remarkable, although you might have been... You might have, well, pressed your hands over your ears as you heard that blast coming through at the beginning of this briefing. I thought it was remarkable, and I think you may agree, that speaking at the midpoint of the Kurukula shift, Alex Jones uses the perfect metaphor for the image of Kurukula in the constellations, namely the image of the archer. The Diamond Sky Dakini Kurukula is associated or correlated to the constellation of the archer. Furthermore, in traditional Tibetan iconography, Kurukula is represented with a bow and arrow. So here we find Alex Jones, whom, whether you like him or not, is regarded, highly regarded, as a counterculture voice in the alternative media. And Jones himself cites the widely influential Matt Drudge, whose Drudge Report serves as a kind of Rosetta Stone for many people. That is to say, it's a link farm. The Drudge Report is a link farm that takes you to controversial events and appears to be, on the surface of it, an anti-Fed and anti-establishment operation or service provided to the public. I'm not going to get into the gory details of either Alex Jones or Matt Drudge, except to say that in the case of the former, I consider Jones to be a Christian demagogue set up in controlled opposition to the authorities in the United States. I'll have a little more to say about Alex Jones further on as we delve into the main subject of this briefing. For right now, I just want to point out that I included that horrific opening to this briefing to get your attention to a remarkable phenomenon of the endopsyche, you could say. People in the media can be, at times, instruments of the endopsyche, or the collective subconscious of the human species. Well, here we find Alex Jones using the analogy of the archer. Those of you who have been following the GNE know that the image of the archer and the gesture of the archer in the constellations have been essential to our navigational process, haven't they? In the first place, the archer participates in what I call the scorpion scales scenario. And that scenario in itself, as I explained in the first year of these briefings, represents the reset of this experiment. The constellations are a psychic feedback and biofeedback device to the human species. The human animal, the anthropos, is especially designed and equipped to interact with the realm of the constellations in a number of ways, but primarily to interact with the constellations as the celestial display of human imagination itself. So we, the human animal, are so endowed in that particular feature of our genius, which comes from the pleromic aeons, that we can look at the constellations in the sky, we can stand in the presence of the constellations, and we can study the images of the constellations on astronomical designs, with or without the graphic designs that I have provided over the years. And in doing all this, we actually engage the power of our imagination in tracking itself. We monitor the operations of the endopsyche of the entire human species. In the GNE navigational process, I have shown you how to do this by observation of two areas of the sky. So far, we have given most attention to the area of the sky where the apogee of the moon transits during the 3 years. That is to say, from the fishes through the ram with the satanic head of Cetus below, and of course the massive body of Cetus stretching below both the ram and the fishes, then into the bull, now into the twins, and finally passing into the crab, or chambered nautilus. The passage of the lunar apogee into the crab represents the completion of the 3 years. And actually, Sophia's correction begins in 2014. In spring of 2014, with the transit of the lunar apogee into the crab. So there you have seen, over the last couple of years, how we monitor the constellations as a way to monitor the workings of human imagination itself. Now when we turn to the opposite part of the sky, we see that the lunar perigee has moved from the Virgin in the spring of 2011, through the scales, into the scorpion, through the legs of the snake tamer, into the archer, and currently it is moving into the goatfish. And at the end of the 3 years, the lunar apogee is located in the goatfish in the constellation correlated to Mahakali and representing the tenfold powers of Kali divided into five and five, that is to say the five Makara powers doubled. In the previous months, I've brought special attention to the details of this panorama of real sky images. This is the real sky zodiac, the observable constellations, as you know. And I've pointed out that the Scorpion reaches up. It appears to be emerging from the stars of the Milky Way. Only the upper torso of the Scorpion actually touches the line of the ecliptic. And with its left claw, it reaches out and jars the crossbeam of the scales. I first paid close attention to this scenario many years back in Santa Fe. That would go back well into the mid-1980s, say going on 30 years now. And at that time, I used the term upset. I said that you can visualize the Scorpion power of the planetary animal mother, upsetting the scales. But as the years evolved, and I found myself engaged in teaching the GNE, I came to change that syntax, and you were happily witnesses of how that happens. You are learning along with me as I learn, so you may at times be witnesses of my correction and of my change of syntax and the efforts by which I hone and refine the language and the exquisite imaginative terminology of this experiment. So I've come to say that the gesture of the Scorpion represents the reset of the scales. And how perfect is that? How wonderful is that? That the image of the reset of the scales is central to the 3 years. Remember that I meticulously plotted the apogee moments in the scales, and there was something like, what, 14 of them, with one unique hit at the fulcrum of the scales around the 20th of August, 2012, I believe. Now, it's also important to bear in mind that the snake tamer participates in this scenario in a very peculiar way, because the snake tamer can be represented as standing upon the Scorpion, its left leg bent with its left foot on Antares, the heart star, and its right leg stiff and coming all the way down to the stinger of the Scorpion. In fact, this is not purely my invention. The International Astronomical Union, I believe that's what it's called, has meticulously determined the borders of the various constellations. And according to their mapping, the stars of the snake tamer do extend down to the stinger of the Scorpion, and to some degree, Scorpion and snake tamer composite stars are merged. So my graphic representation of the snake tamer standing above the Scorpion is not a fantasy and is well grounded in astronomical fact, or astronomical convention would be a better word. Well, what do you make of this picture? The 13th constellation, the one that was excluded when the sign format of Ptolemy was installed, as it were, around 150 AD. What do you make of the fact that there is a male yogi figure, a shaman figure wrestling a snake who stands above the Scorpion? Well, in some way, it suggests to me that the shamanic powers of the snake tamer and the mastery of the serpent power belong to the dynamic of correction. Somehow, those powers, or to be more precise, those individuals among us who master those powers and talents of shamanism will play a key role in adjusting, maintaining, and regulating the reset. What do you think of that? Well, I just came up with that, okay? That's my current view of how to regard the snake tamer graphically as part of the scorpion scale scenario. But hold on, me mateys, hold on. It gets even better. Because looking to the left, as viewed from the northern hemisphere, looking to the left, or east, you see that even the archer participates in the scorpion scale scenario. Clearly, the gesture of the archer, pulling back the arrow but not firing, ready to fire, and aiming not at Antares but at Eta Scorpionis. Remember that term, Eta Scorpion? Eta Scorpionis, which is lower in the torso of the scorpion. That entire picture also belongs to the scenario of reset. Reset is the term I'm using, taken from IT and archonic technology. Is the term I'm using here for the setting up of the initial conditions of correction in 3 years. The reset is made in 3 years, and then the reset is manifested, implemented, and applied in the remaining 200 years to the end of the Kalpa. We are intimate witnesses to the reset. The purpose of the GNE is to monitor and observe how the reset occurs, how the reset is accomplished by the Aeon Sophia herself. Now, I'd like to add that there are several meanings to the graphics of the archer. Not only does the archer aim at the scorpion, thus appearing to exert some kind of deterrent effect, but it can be shown that a place very close to the tip of the archer's arrow, located just above the stinger of the scorpion, corresponds to the sight line in the direction of the galactic center. Therefore, I put it to you, my friends, that those initiates who did not design the constellations, because obviously they are products of the cosmic order, but those initiates who taught the perception and observation of the constellations according to graphic design, intentionally suggested the image of the archer in this way. They taught their students, the Teleste taught their students how to visualize these composite stars. I assure you, if you go out and look at the constellation of the archer regarding its composites, that is to say, the component stars without graphics, you'd be very hard put to see an archer in that star formation. The same applies for almost all the other constellations in the sky. They simply do not resemble the creatures or objects to which they have been assigned, or which have been assigned to them, imaginatively speaking. One exception being the scorpion that really does appear to look like a scorpion, particularly with the distinctive curve of the tail and the stinger. That is an unmistakable graphic element. But with the constellation of the archer, you have to add the graphics of the half-man, half-horse, the gesture of one hand extending forward, holding the bow, the other hand pulled back to the neck or cheek of the archer, holding the vein of the arrow. And all these points, by the way, are marked by marked precisely by specific stars. You have to add that graphic visualization. And that is a conscious act of design. You consciously add the graphics, you observe the composites. Is that clear? Well, who initially proposed the visualization along these lines. Who initially designed the constellations? I tell you that it was the Teleste who knew, for instance, from time immemorial, that the direction of sight above the tail of the stinger of the scorpion goes to the center of our galaxy. So the sighting gesture of the archer has another level of meaning. The aim is toward the torso of the scorpion, in some way exerting a deterrent effect upon the lethal power of Scorpion Mother. Just as the snake tamer, the master of Kundalini, does a balancing act on the scorpion and in some way regulates the power of Scorpion Mother, likewise does the restraining or deterrent gesture of the archer. And there are other meanings as well that could be drawn from the gesture of the archer. Needless to say, it's quite remarkable that Alex Jones uses the language that he uses. At one point he says, the set of things, the way it's going to go. And he refers that to the gesture of the archer pulling back and aiming the arrow and sighting on the target. And he says explicitly that this sighting process is now in effect, and that 2014 is the year in which the arrow will be released. So in effect, what Alex Jones is saying is exactly what I'm saying in the language of the GNE, using the spectacular graphic effects of the constellations. He does not, of course, refer to the constellations. He doesn't refer to me or the GNE, though he certainly knows about me. And he doesn't refer to Kurukula, who happens to be the overseeing Dakini on the shift on December 15th, when he uses this vivid and pertinent analogy. So make of it what you will. The takeaway from all this, I would say, is that 2014 is the year of reckoning for humanity on this planet. And for some time now, a number of people have been saying that. Gerald Celente, for instance. People are beginning to say, in the media, in the alternative media, and even in the mainstream media, that 2014 is the turning point due to the culmination of escalating events over the past decade, say since 9/11, and due to the way in which the alternative media, insofar as it is an organ of truth and exposure of lies, is catching up with the lies and catching up with the criminals. So there is continual talk, still in the realm of fear-mongering, about a great financial meltdown in 2014. And more people are concurring, more and more of the so-called experts concur that this financial meltdown will occur in 2014. Well, I agree, but I would ask you to change the language from financial meltdown, which is fear-mongering syntax, to end of the financial crime wave. How about that? How about predicting that the financial crime wave on this planet will come to an end in 2014? It never could have crossed my mind years ago, say 20 years ago, that I would have realized in March of 2011 that the correction of the Aeon Sophia was going to happen, and the initial conditions would require 3 years. I didn't see that coming, although I'd been waiting for it for 40 years. I'd been waiting for the precise astronomical clue to correction, even before I knew it would be the clue to correction. And likewise, 20 years ago, I would have laughed if you told me that I was going to call this three-year period for Sophia's correction, ending in March 2014, and that it would just so happen that many, many people in the realm of global discourse would express their conviction that 2014 was the year of reckoning for humanity. So how do you like them potatoes? Now, I have to say that I haven't been entirely specific or diligent and conscientious in keeping you up to date with the perigee hits in the Archer. So get out your pencil and paper and take down these notes as I'll give you the dates and the locations during this year, 2013. It so happens that the first hit of the lunar perigee in the Archer was January 10th, 2013, 1 degree of Capricorn. That puts it at the forward hand of the Archer who holds the bow. That also places it in the aphelion of Saturn, by the way. And remember that the apsides of Saturn are connected with the Gnostic movement. The second hit was February 7th in 10 Capricorn. That is near the hand of the Archer that holds the vein of the arrow. The third hit was then in June 23rd, 2013, again in 2 Capricorn, very close to the forward hand of the Archer holding the bow. June 21st, 15 degrees of Capricorn, again closely associated with the hand pulling back the string. On August 19th, there was a perigee hit in 28 Capricorn, that is in the empty space behind the Archer. And then, on December 4th, just a couple of weeks ago, there was the final and third hit in the part of the Archer associated with the forward hand. December 4th, a perigee hit in 2 Capricorn. Upcoming in the year 2014, you have the following. On January 1st, there's a perigee hit in 14 Capricorn. That is again near the hand holding the, pulling back the string. And that's it, except for May 18th, 2014, when there is, again, a hit in 16 Capricorn, which is close to the elbow of the Archer. That would be considered to be the last formal hit in the constellation of the Archer. Now, if you look at this pattern of perigee hits or surges, you find that it's remarkable that from the very first month of 2013, turning the pages here in my ragged notes, from January of 2013, with the first hit at the forward hand, all the way through the year 2013 and down to December 4th, there are in all three hits toward the forward hand. Now, I would ask you to stop for a moment and imitate the gesture of the Archer. Hold one hand out as if you're grasping the bow and pull the other hand back toward your cheek or neck as if you're holding the vein of the arrow and extending the tension of the string and get the feeling of the thrust. The forward thrust of the hand is different from the backward thrust, isn't it? In fact, the forward thrust is in the forward hand, obviously, and the backward pulling thrust is in the hand that pulls the string. They pull in opposite directions. So there has been a factor of tension in establishing the forward and backward thrust of the Archer's gesture. This is a factor in the reset process, establishing or adjusting this tension. So reading from the constellational image, I would say that what has been happening in the year 2013 is an adjustment of that tension. The tension has been adjusting itself in the endopsyche of the collective human animal, of the collective mind, and also in your individual psyches and lives. You have been adjusting the tension of the forward and the backward thrust. Such adjustments are conditions of the set, as Alex Jones calls it, the set that will determine the events that that follow, the events that unfold with the release of the arrow in March of 2014. And I would say that this entire picture and the timing shown by the perigee hits in the Archer is extremely revealing and could be studied in great detail if you wanted to go back and look at those moments and see what reflections in current events might have been related to those moments of adjusting the stress of the Archer's aim. Now, with that much said, I'd like to plunge into the main subject of this briefing, which is the end of Jumanity. And I'm spelling it J-U-M-A-N-I-T-Y, but it could also be spelled J-E-W-M-A-N-I-T-Y. You know, this pun on the word Jew is widely found in the current alternative media, the Jew World Order, Jew York, and terms of that kind, Jewtopia. There's even a comedy film that was released recently called Jewtopia. I'd hate to think of what Jewtopia is, but maybe some visions of Jewtopia will come to your mind in the remainder of this briefing. First of all, I want to define what I mean by Jumanity. Jumanity is the definition of humanity by those who define themselves as Jews. So there is a double definition implied in the term Jumanity. In the first place, you have to have people who define themselves as Jews. I have proposed the term posagi for such people. People of self-assumed Jewish identity. P-O-S-A-G-I. So there are on this planet, by some accounts, they represent 2% or less of the American population. Globally, they represent a minute fraction of the total population of the human species, who are posagis. Other people don't have to call them Jews. Other people, such as myself, don't have to point a finger at them and say, "Hey, you Jew." They define themselves as Jews. They are posagis, people of self-assumed Jewish identity. That's the first definition. But then, those posagis, in turn, have a particular definition of humanity. Their definition of humanity, I would point out, does not agree with the definition of humanity according to all non-posagis. The Jewish definition of humanity, or Jumanity, is in fact at odds with the Gentile definition of humanity. And this is simply a fact of history and a fact of current events that you would be foolish to deny. Now you might wonder why I've decided to undertake this talk about Jews, posagis, and humanity at this particular time. Well, it relates very closely to the gesture of sighting in the constellation of the Archer. This topic relates closely to that imagery. But I was also triggered to undertake this topic by something that I came across on the internet a couple of weeks ago, just before I left on my trip to France. I don't know how it happened, but something came up in a search engine, and I clicked on a page where there was a discussion about yours truly. Now, I haven't been able to find this page again, typically, and I didn't bookmark it. But it was a page, or a blogspot, or a WordPress platform, dedicated to Saint Germain, the teachings of Saint Germain. So in the upper left-hand corner, there was a typical kitsch image of Saint Germain looking rather like Jesus coming out of the John Peters hair salon in Beverly Hills around 1977, and holding a Grail cup and looking very magisterial and masculine and authoritative. And the dudes who were discussing my work on this site are apparently practitioners of yoga as well as followers of the mystique of the Count of Saint-Germain. And they were discussing the issue of my comments on Jews. And they were saying that it might be considered discrediting to me that I make these comments. Many people, you know, would argue that anyone who fingers the Jews or scapegoats the Jews, no, excuse me, anyone who holds the Jews accountable for evils in this world may be easily dismissed for scapegoating the Jews. This is a common tactic of discourse. So, you know, scapegoating means to blame someone unfairly. So, anyone who points out that Jews are widely represented in some social evils, for instance, in the financing of wars throughout history, can easily be dismissed as scapegoating the Jews. And so what in effect they were saying, they were debating, was, well, gee, why does Lash, who appears to be a spiritually enlightened person in so many ways, fall into this obviously unenlightened habit of pointing the finger at the Jews and blaming the Jews for the evils of the world? And they were, as far as I remember from scanning the article, they were inclined to make the conclusion that I had not purified my astral body or my chakra system sufficiently. I had not taken down enough light or ascended into the light to the extent where the light had reached my lower chakras. And so I was exhibiting a lower chakra response by making accusations against the Jews. So that little snippet that I came across on the internet stuck in my mind, and so I thought I would give the world the opportunity to know in full detail why I designate the Jews as a group of people who are at the heart of planetary evil. Now, in the first place, if you want to know the background of my argument, you can go and read Not in His Image. And in the first six chapters of Not in His Image, I give a very concise, action-packed summary of the Zadokite movement among the ancient Hebrews. And I point out that the Zadokite movement is the kernel of terrorism in the world today. I point to the four features of the Palestinian Redeemer complex, that is to say, a male creator God who solely creates and rules over the world, a chosen people selected from the totality of the human race and set aside by the creator God, the Messiah who is sent by the creator God, and finally, the Day of Judgment or Retribution, in which the Messiah and the Creator God rule over humanity and exert retribution upon those who have disobeyed the rules of the Father God and reward those who have followed His divine plan. Such is my exposition in not in his image of the Zadokite ideology of world domination. And I must say that many, many people have written me over the past 5 or 6, 7 years telling me that that exposition was a tremendous revelation in their lives and has liberated them from religious conditioning in their Judeo-Christian faith, and also that it has set their sights straight upon the problems facing humanity at this time. I just want to point out in summary and reiterate in summary that the Zadokite ideology is the source of master race ideology. It's not the Nazis who invented master race ideology. In fact, as far as I know, you can check this out, the term master race in its German equivalent cannot even be found in the speeches of Adolf Hitler or in any of the written propaganda, if you will, of the Nazi Party. The accusation that Nazis followed a master race agenda comes largely from those who do, in fact, follow that agenda and who would like to falsely attribute it to their enemies. So, I think it would be a wonderful moment for humanity when many, many people in many walks of life could all agree on this one point, namely that racism, racial supremacy, and master race ideology originate with the ancient Hebrews. They originate specifically in the cult of the Zadokim, whose writings can be found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But that master race ideology unfortunately contaminates the entire field of Jewish culture and Jewish identity. That is very unfortunate for those people of Jewish origin, whether their identity be established by some racial connection to Judaism or purely by a religious connection to Judaism. It is extremely unfortunate that those people who would include themselves in the Jewish racial religious identity complex are contaminated by association, whether they know it or not. That is extremely unfortunate. I am certain that the Posadzis I've known in my life would not have the faintest idea of what I'm talking about here. They would not even have a suspicion that their odd and vague sense of being special as Jews could go back to such an evil and nefarious conception. But that is in fact the case. And the way that I see it, and I speak with kindness and even affection toward Posadzis, the way that I see it is that the end of humanity would be really good for them as much as it would be for Goyim and Gentiles like myself. And if there is anything that can unite the Goyim and the Posadzis, it is a common wish to end humanity. That is to say, to oppose and defeat the definition of humanity according to those who define themselves as Jews against humanity. So let's return to the question that was raised by the little snippet I read on the internet. Why would John Lash, a seemingly educated and enlightened person, fall into the tactic of fingering the Jews for all the evil in the world? First of all, let me make it clear that I do not blame Jews or people who call themselves Jews, such as Eastern European Ashkenazis and Khazars, I do not blame them for all the evil in the world, but I put them in the central and executive role of social evil in the world. I do give them their due. The way to give them their due is to look at their overrepresentation in certain areas of human endeavor. It is a well-known fact that Jews are overrepresented in world finance, in the media, in the entertainment business, and in other affairs such as enrollment in Ivy League universities. Right now, the situation is that the enrollment of Jews at Harvard is proportionally much, much higher than their actual present representation in the population. So this is just a statistical fact. And many people, more and more all the time, in fact, are drawing attention to the overrepresentation or the disproportionate influence of Jews in certain critical areas of national and global activity. And so I would argue to you that if Jews are happy to assume this role of being overrepresented, then they might also consider the likelihood that some individuals, such as myself, will regard them as overrepresented as well in the machinations of social evil on this planet. They are not the only instruments of social evil, but they are at the heart of social evil, and they are the primary and predominant agents of social evil at the executive level. They operate on an agenda of social evil calculated against non-Jewish humanity. Of course, when I say they, I need to make an important qualification. This is indeed the essential qualification. When I say they, meaning Jews, are the primary agents of social evil at the executive level, I don't mean all people who define themselves as Jews. But unfortunately, all people who define themselves as Jews, insofar as they do not individually disown this agenda of social evil against humanity perpetrated by some Jews, they are accessory to it, unwittingly or not. It is extremely unfortunate that Jewish identity functions as a psyop upon this planet. Jewish identity is a psyop. One of the primary characteristics of any psyop is that it splits the mind into alternatives or dichotomies which are confusing and cannot be resolved. That is the hallmark of a psyop. And how is that demonstrated in Jewish identity? Well, is Jewish identity a matter of race or religion? This is the question that comes up in anyone's mind when the term Jew is used. And the answer is, there is no answer. The answer is, there is no way to resolve the race-religion dichotomy contained in the word Jewish. It is intended to be confusing. It creates cognitive dissonance. If you argue that Judaism is just a religion and that anyone who adopts the precepts of that religion is therefore Jewish, then you exclude the whole argument for the ethnic, racial, and genetic dimension of Judaism. But if you look into the ethnic, racial, and genetic dimension of Judaism, you find that it's completely confused. And the very genetic profile of Jewish identity has been debunked numerous times, even by so-called, you know, self-defined Jewish researchers. So the whole concept of Jewish identity is in itself a massive psyop. But why would that be so? Why isn't the identity of the Inuit Indians of Greenland, or the identity of Argentinians, or of Sicilians, or Tasmanians, why aren't those identities designed in such a way that they operate as a psyop? Simply because behind the Jewish identity, no matter how you cut it, is the master race agenda of the Tzaddikim. And the only thing that a Pasaji today can do, who does not wish to be associated with this agenda, is to disown the agenda consciously and openly. Disown it and take a stance against it. So we may find in the year 2014, as correction unfolds, that more and more people of self-assumed Jewish identity consciously and openly and publicly take a stand against Jewmanity. How they would do that, I don't know. But I'd venture to say that they better find out how to do that for the sake of their own survival. I want to be crystal clear about what I'm saying right now, because it comes as a kind of a warning. The concept of humanity is, of course, extremely dangerous and problematic for humanity. A species divided against itself cannot survive. But the concept of humanity, stemming from the master race theory of the Tzaddikim, is equally dangerous for Jews, and perhaps even more so. Some of you may know the record of expulsions of Jews from countries all around the world over 2,000 years. It goes back to 70 AD with the expulsion of Jews from Palestine by the Emperor Titus. Then it comes forward through many, many expulsions. And in some countries, over and over again, Jews have been thrown out. You can go and examine this record on the internet. Just put it into a search engine. It's an impressive record. Yet this record of expulsions only shows the evidence of national and regional reactions to those who represent humanity, that is to say, who live according to the agenda of a divided humanity. And as terrible as these expulsions may have been for those Jewish communities in different places, in different countries, at different times through the last 2,000 years, it's nothing compared to what could happen if the entirety of humanity globally turned against the Jews. And I have to say, although I do not predict, I do consider that event to be inevitable. And when humanity as a whole turns against Jewmanity, then It might happen. It could very well happen. That those who define themselves as Jews, whether or not they are consciously complicit in the agenda of anti-human master race ideology, will find themselves not only expelled from one country or another, but expelled from the planet itself. You know, upon reflection, and I certainly have reflected on this topic a great deal and deeply over many years, upon reflection, I'd venture to say that I perceive something like a death wish in the psyche of the Jewish people. To put it in another way, I would say that the seed of master race ideology exhibited by some Jews throughout history is inseparable from a death wish. Why do I say that? Well, were that ideology to be seen for what it is, were it to be fully exposed and regarded honestly for what it is, according to its historical record, it would bring down a death sentence upon those Jews who foster and perpetrate that ideology. No question about it. A species divided against itself cannot survive. Humanity is the definition of the human race applied by those who define themselves as Jews who follow an agenda of separation, supremacy, and domination regarding all who are non-Jews. And you can't say it any better than that, can you? You know, I have had Jewish friends through my life, and Jewish girlfriends even. And I am certain, it goes back a ways, but I've had them, and I am certain that none of them ever had the faintest idea about the Palestinian Redeemer complex, the Zadokim cult, and those nefarious matters. I am certain that none of them had the faintest idea that you don't find the term master race in German in the writings and speeches of Hitler or in any Nazi documents. But that master race ideology is a product of Judaic culture. It originates with the ancient Hebrews in the splinter sect of the Zadokim. And even not in the splinter sect, because those Jews in the time of the beginning of the Christian era, and you can read all about this in the first six chapters of Not in This Image, who did not embrace the radical and extreme racism of the Zadokim, nevertheless embraced the notion that Jews are different in some way. This is the quaint, sentimental notion that many Jews have. Oh yes, there's something different about being Jewish. Well, is there really? I don't think so. I don't think there's anything different about being Jewish that makes a Posagi first a Jew and then a human being. We are all human beings first. And after that, you can play with racial and ethnic flavoring any way you like. We are all in the same human soup, but you can season it with ethnic and racial flavoring any way you like. I happen to like ethnic and racial flavoring. The biodiversity of nature is reflected in the diversity of styles and qualities and expressions of ethnic groups in the Anthropos. And that diversity is exciting and intriguing to observe. I myself am a human animal that comes in an Irish-Italian flavor. And I enjoy my flavor. but I don't say that I'm Irish before I'm human. I don't say that I'm Italian before I'm human. I don't say that I'm Catholic or Jewish or even Gnostic before I'm human, because I am human before anything else and above anything else. And in that unity, the identity of the species, the anthropos, is held and revered so that we can thrive in the endowment of the pleromic aeons. But the concept of humanity is calculated against that endowment. The concept of humanity is an archontic lie that has been planted in the human species and entered the collective mind of humanity through the vector of the ancient Hebrews. Now today, Jews openly declare their power and their influence. A miserable little country like Israel openly declares its massive influence in global affairs and its influence over the United States. A Jew such as Joel Stein openly declares what no non-Jew would be allowed to say. Yes, we Jews run Hollywood and the government as well, and we don't care if anyone knows it as long as we can keep running it. This is openly stated by a Jew about the overrepresentation of Jews in the media, in Hollywood, and so forth. AIPAC, the Jewish lobby that controls the American Congress, has a disproportionate influence upon American policy, such that the country is running to the toilet in the favor of policies for Israel and for the minuscule Jewish community. And this is all a fact. These are all well-established facts of our time. And so when I target the Jews, what am I doing? Well, I'm applying the mythological image of the archer in yet another aspect. Step back now and look at the entire scenario. The scorpion reaches up and jars the crossbeam of the scales. This is the reset of this experiment before the experiment ends its day, its cosmic day in 2216. This reset before the end of the day is an anomaly. Sophia's correction can only occur because of a previous anomaly that caused her to be included within the experiment. Because she is here, she is not only the source of the human genome, but she is the setting for the experiment in which the human genome is discovering and developing its divine endowment. Due to that anomaly, she can correct the experiment from within. Otherwise, she would be required to follow standard procedure with the aeons, and that is to reset the experiment at the end of each kalpa. What we are looking for today is a reset about 2 centuries before the end of the kalpa. This is a very, very great opportunity for the human species, not only to realize itself, to clean up its own act and rise to its divine potential, but also to collaborate in a most intimate way with the designs and purposes of the Wisdom Goddess. In this momentous image of reset, 2 other factors come into play. The balancing act of the snake tamer above the scorpion. As I've suggested for the first time in this briefing, this image represents the way that those who master the practices of shamanism play a role in regulating the reset and the outcome of reset. Clear enough? Finally, there is the image of the archer, which I have said represents the application of a kind of deterrent force against the powers of Mother Scorpion. But at the same time, the image of the archer, by the gesture of sighting on the target, represents plainly and simply seeing the target. And who is the target? What is the target? Well, the target is humanity. The Jews have to be targeted, but they have to be targeted in the right way and in a sober and compassionate way, in full understanding that they are their own worst enemies, in making themselves the enemies of humanity. You know, you might ask anyone you meet if you'd like to have a really interesting conversation. Of course, it might not get past the first minute or so, but you could try. You might ask anyone. You might, in this way, you might say, I have two questions for you. The first question is, who are the enemies of humanity? And see how they respond to that question. And then, whatever they say, you say to them, okay, now I have a second question. Realize it's kind of difficult to answer the first question. We could speculate and various people could be named, you know, maybe the aliens, maybe the archons are the enemies of humanity, whatever. But here's a second question that might hit you a little bit differently. Who are the self-declared enemies of humanity? Now, I'd like to see what response that gets. If you go through the nations of this world, starting with the Aborigines of Australia, the Apaches, and all the way down the line to the Zuni, and everyone in between, including Panamanians and those who live in Corsica and those who live in remote provinces of China, I don't think that you will find any people or race that have openly declared themselves to be the enemies of humanity apart from themselves, who are considered to be a chosen or separate race. I don't think that you will find that there is any case of self-declared antagonism toward humanity except that which you find in the religious documents of the ancient Hebrews, starting with the Old Testament, going to the Babylonian Talmud, and coming forward through the Khazars to the protocols of the elders of Zion. So I target the Jews, yes I do, and I take full responsibility for doing it. It's not because my lower chakras are clogged up with sludge, and the light of divine love has not yet permeated my soul. It's a calculated judgment based on long and careful analysis of the situation humanity is facing. Humanity is the way that humanity is defined by a group who separates themselves from humanity and stand apart, defined as a chosen people. Humanity is not your definition of the human species if you include yourself in the species along with everyone else. So, correction requires the end of humanity, and I mean the total and final end. I see numerous signs that indicate that the end of humanity is coming. Does this mean that I'm calling for a final solution to the Jewish people? Not at all. By the way, the term final solution was introduced by a Jewish ideologue at the beginning of the 1940s in reference to the German people, by the way. It was not a solution, it was not a term that originates with anti-Jewish Nazi activities or alleged activities. So am I proposing in the end of humanity the extermination of all Jews from the face of the earth? Of course not. Of course not. In fact, I would hope that as many self-defined Jews as possible can escape from the retribution that is likely to come down upon the head of those who follow this agenda of master race ideology, including manipulation and domination of Goyim and Gentiles. What we have seen over the last decade or so, largely due to the internet, it must be admitted, is a massive and escalating exposure of the lie in the narrative on this planet. And the central lie is the lie of Jewish identity and Jewish victimhood. Because in fact, those Jews who follow the agenda of the Zads are the worst perpetrators on this planet, and the historical record proves it to be so. So I do not blame Jews for all the evils in the world. There are many non-Jewish accessories to evil, and some of them are even in executive positions now and then. But by and large, over time, and in the current world scenario, it is people who define themselves as Jews and stand against the rest of humanity who occupy the executive levels of social evil. You can say that I target them, but you can also say that they're wearing a target, that their Jewish identity is a target. So I propose to all Posages who do not wish to have this action come down on them to take off that Jewish identity if it's possible and disown your association with humanity so that you can join humanity and be safe. And I do wish safety to all those who may come in the line of fire in the year 2014 and onward, when the world as a whole and humanity as a whole, for the first and last time, turns against the Jumans. That moment is coming. That moment is unavoidable. And that moment is a central event in the process that we call Sophia's correction.